Right, good morning, everybody. Welcome to this session on Active Directory tips, tricks, and best practice. If you're looking for the business intelligence talk, it's next door. You'll find no intelligence in this presentation. One of the things, I got a text from my wife this morning. She said, good luck, and remember to wear trousers. So I did that, and what could possibly go wrong from here? Okay, so this is a session, actually. If you've been to TechEd before, you may have seen me stand up and give presentations on AD before. This is the session that I've been wanting to do for a number of years, and Microsoft in the past have just often asked me to cover what's emerging technology and what's happening. And I've really wanted to give this session because it's based on sort of experience that I've gained out in the field working with customers in New Zealand and elsewhere. So if you've got any questions during the session, please feel free to just ask them as we go along. Also, I've got a Twitter account, Mr. Tweetastic. It's something of a misnomer. I'm sort of both my followers on Twitter enjoy my monthly tweets. So, just feel free to send through a question. I'll be following up on questions afterwards. It's also got a link to my blog site, www.openersocket.com, where I post a lot of the content and a lot of the, the value from this presentation is derived from the blog. So, in fact, you don't need to be here at all. In fact, I'd rather be at Scott Schnoll's session on Exchange, but there you go. Okay, so let's make a start. The way this is going to work is basically there's no particular running order, there's no particular sequence of this. I've got some quick tips interspersed with some more in-depth content and quite a few demos. So the first one here is that back in 2008, Microsoft introduced this concept of protection from accidental deletion for AD objects, certain types of AD objects, and that was built into the UI tools. That's fine for newly created objects in AD, but what about a lot of organizations out here probably had AD going for 10 years or more and have objects that were created some time ago, which may not be protected from accidental deletion. So here's a quick PowerShell one-liner. It's using the AD PowerShell commandlets. It basically just grabs all of the organizational units within your domain and sets the protection from accidental deletion flag. So it's quite a nice one to do. One thing I would say is that you could take this a step further and say, hey, I want to protect all of my objects within the domain. That will break stuff. So for example, if you've got a delegation model in place, sometimes setting that protection from accidental deletion flag on user objects will prevent you being able to move them from one OU to another. Okay, so let's talk about finding inactive objects. And one thing I found is that working with organizations in New Zealand, they tend to do offboarding or deprovisioning of users pretty well for full-time employees, but not necessarily so well for casual or temporary staff and contractors, and certainly not for things like training accounts and test accounts and exchange resource accounts, for example. They tend to get missed off. And I've seen the sort of full range of deprovisioning badness, ranging from the poor to the bad to the very bad to the buttock-clenchingly bad. And it's something that really sort of a lot of organizations ignore. So traditionally, a good way to look for users that are inactive has been to use the last log on timestamp and maybe perform an LDAP query. In the past, some command line tools, particularly one from www.joeware.net called AD Find, was really useful for finding AD accounts that were inactive. Nowadays, things are much simpler with the AD PowerShell commandlet. So you've got a really useful one called Search AD Account, and there's an example there of finding users that have been active that haven't basically logged onto the domain in the last 90 days. And as you're probably aware, for those of you who work with AD a lot, computers also perform a log onto the domain, so you can find inactive computers in exactly the same way. So really, for groups, that's a lot more challenging. To find inactive groups, the reason is because they don't log onto the domain group. So how do you know whether something is inactive or not? And certainly, as our Active Directory environments get older and older and older, we get this kind of proliferation of inactive groups. So one way you can try and look for inactive groups is to search for groups with empty membership. Now, it's not an entirely reliable way of doing it because you can potentially have a group that's just a sort of placeholder for an application that does genuinely have an empty group membership. If you find, if you pull out a list of groups that you know or you think might be inactive, one of the things you can do is basically convert those, if they're security groups, to distribution lists. And the reason for that is that if somebody screams and says, well, I can no longer access that file share, or I can no longer print, or whatever, you can quickly revert the distribution group back to its security group. Of course, things are also easier nowadays with the AD recycle bin. So if you do decide to purge a whole lot of AD groups, you can quickly get them back with a recycle bin. Okay, so let's launch into the first demo. This is really just showing the ability to use PowerShell to find those inactive accounts. So in my lab environment, I don't have a whole lot of users that have logged on in the last 90 days. So quickly going to, oh, by the way, this is the new PowerShell integrated scripting environment. It's there in sort of 2012 and in R2 as well. If you're using PowerShell and don't know about the integrated scripting environment, or ISE, then I'd strongly encourage you to take a look. It offers a really neat way of sort of pre-staging your scripts and commandlets and looking at them as they run. Okay, so we run through here. We can see from the output at the bottom that we're picking up a lot of accounts that are potentially inactive, so haven't logged on in the last day. Straight at the bottom there, what you'll see is the last logon date, which is actually not an AD attribute. It's a PowerShell interpretation, a user-friendly view of the last logon timestamp attribute. In this case, it's missing. So one thing to be aware of when searching for AD accounts that are inactive is that you're going to pick up things that have never logged onto the domain. And one logical consequence of that is that some objects may have been created in the last week. You know, so your service desk may have provisioned users who are going to start the following week, and you certainly don't want to be deleting those or disabling them. So one thing you can do is basically pipe the results of the search AD account through to get AD user and get some more properties, including the when created attribute. And this will show you basically the ones that were created recently versus the ones that were created some time ago. And then you can sort of, if you want, go a step further and export that to a CSV file and look at it in Excel and filter it. So again, searching for computers that are inactive is exactly the same. I think my view is that with users, a lot of organizations tend to avoid actually deleting inactive users. For records compliance, they need to keep the AD accounts in place for some time. Some go ahead and delete them after a period of time of being disabled. But for computer accounts, I would say just go ahead and delete them. The reason for that is that you can always just rejoin the computer to the domain. And essentially, if it's showing as being inactive for a period of time, then probably it genuinely is no longer around. Just a quick word then about the finding groups with empty membership. There are some groups within AD that are marked as critical objects. Now, these include things like the groups that we know, so enterprise admins, schema admins, the built-in administrators group, and so on. So we really don't want to be messing with those and deleting those, do we? So one good idea is to basically introduce into your LDAP filter an exclusion of the groups that are basically critical system objects. So let's go ahead and run that and see what the output comes back with. So you'll see still showing things like DNS admins. Now, DNS admins is, again, a group that's created when you create the domain or create the forest. It's not marked as a critical object. So the implication of all of this is that, yes, we can use the tools to develop the list and come up with a candidates, if you like, for deletion. But you really need to have a sort of human eye pass over that on a case-by-case basis to determine whether we think something is genuinely inactive or not. I would strongly encourage you also, as part of the general approach to object lifecycle management, is to populate as much information you can about ownership and use of an object. So, for example, if you're creating a new OU, then give it the change request number, put it in there, mark somebody as the contact point for that OU, and try and do that as far as possible with objects that you manage. Okay. Single server subnet. So if, like you, we try not to test our changes in production, you have a lab environment. Quite often when you have a lab environment, you have a single subnet. And with a single subnet, it's quite hard then to simulate multiple AD sites. There is a way around that, and one neat method of doing this is to basically define single server subnets. So to do that, you basically take the IP address of the server that you're interested in, define it as a subnet with a /32 suffix, and that will allow you then to create a site with that one subnet joined to it. That's a really nice, easy way of creating a lab environment with multiple sites. Okay, so let's talk about optimizing AD site design. One of the things I see a lot is people who haven't really kind of thought through the AD site design process and who lump a whole lot of sites together on either the default site link or on or one of the existing site links. AD sort of kind of protects you from that level of idiocy in a way that basically it'll still work as long as you have sort of reasonable network connectivity. It just isn't optimal because it's not reflecting the underlying network. And what you're trying to achieve with your AD site design is to sort of have a logical layer that represents the underlying network layer. There's also some potentially confusing information on TechNet. TechNet documentation around sites and services is really targeted at everyone from, you know, the sort of AD environment that's got tens of people to your Toyotas of the world that have got hundreds of thousands of people all over the world with multiple sites. So they come up with some really interesting advice about how to calculate, for example, site link costs. You don't need to go to that extent. I think the takeaway from this should be that just try and keep it as simple as possible and make some comments, common sense decisions about site link costs and so on. So here's a very typical New Zealand AD sites and services model. We've got two hub sites, site B and site C. We've got two satellite sites or branch sites, A and D. And really what you want to do is have a low-cost link established between the branch site and the hub site with which it has the closest affinity. So that affinity might be based on network speed or bandwidth. It might be based on contention. It might be based on the latency. You know, you really need to do an analysis of what your network underlying your sites looks like. And then you typically want to have a secondary link with a higher cost connecting to your secondary hub site. Again, it's a really simple model to follow. So in terms of the takeaways here, we've already mentioned that basically avoiding loading multiple sites onto a site link. Make sure that you register those AD subnets. So one of the things that domain controllers do, I think, every 24 hours is it basically logs an event in the event log telling you which subnets are unregistered. Now, an unregistered subnet, as I'm sure most of you are aware, is not good because it means the client has lost site affinity. And it might be that when they do their log on, for example, the group policy processing is being done and authentication is being done from a DC in some far-flung corner of your network. So really what you want to do is sort of, if you have a monitoring solution in place, look up, basically monitor and alert on those missing subnets through the event. If you don't have monitoring in place, all of those missing subnets are also logged to the net log on, which is a text file on each domain controller. So periodically, just have a look for that and register each missing subnet with its appropriate site. We're going to talk in a demo about enabling change notification on site links. Now, there's a story sort of way back in the days of Windows 2000 AD. Microsoft found that with some of their larger customers, the knowledge consistency checker, the KCC, working together with the inter-site topology generator, didn't scale beyond a certain number of sites. And their advice at the time was to disable site transitivity, disable the KCC, create manual connection objects, and do it that way. Then in the sort of 2003 AD era, Microsoft said, well, our algorithm obviously doesn't work. And at that time, they had a mathematics department at Redmond. And they said to the maths kind of boffins, just go ahead and give us an algorithm that scales. And so after a short time, they came back and said, right, here's your algorithm. And it's worked pretty well from then on. So by all means, if you want to sort of take a plunge and manage everything manually, go ahead. But certainly I'll recommend otherwise that you just keep everything that's enabled by default. Try not to create manual connection objects. Okay, so let's have a look at enabling change notification on site links. So one of the things to bear in mind here is that, or to really understand how replication works both within a site and how it works inter-site. So within an AD site, basically, change notification is the way that replication works. So what happens is a change is made on a DC within a site. It says, right, I'll wait 15 seconds, and I'll notify my first replication partner that I've got this change. Basically, replication takes place with that replication partner within site. There's a short delay, while it notifies the other domain controllers of the change. And that way, sort of basically, the default cycle was 15 seconds. That was changed from 5 minutes, I think, in the 2003 era. So it's very quick. Changes happen very quickly with insights. Now, inter-site replication, as I'm sure most of you know, is different. And you can only set the interval for replication down to 15 minutes. You can't go below that. But what you can do is enable change notification, which basically just changes the replication behavior for inter-site replication so that it works the same as in-site. And obviously, that's going to have something of an impact. So what's going to happen is basically, if you've got really slow bandwidth with links, they could all of a sudden start to get really busy on a permanent basis. So, you know, within New Zealand, we've generally got pretty good network connectivity. We've got high-speed bandwidth linking most of the country. So generally, I would say it's reasonably safe to enable change notification. And the big benefit of this is that, I'll give you an example. So let's say that you've got a user who's locked out his account, and he's in site A. Service desk operate with affinity to site B. So the service desk unlock his account. Then basically there's a 15-minute delay or longer, depending on what the site replication interval is configured for, while that account waits to get unlocked. So with change notification enabled, that would occur within 15 seconds or so. So let's just have a look and see where there that change notification is enabled. So I'm in a bit of a hunched position over here. The HDMI cable wouldn't extend to here, so I've got to do some acrobatics to get the demos working. Okay, so I've got a site here, Auckland to Hamilton. And this is Sites and Services snap-in running on a 2012 R2 DC. What I really like about the 2012 and R2 stuff is you get the attribute editor in the UI. One of the huge benefits of the attribute editor is that it's available with the Active Directory Administrative Center from search. I don't know if you're aware of this, but if you you know, you can't get to the attribute editor if you search from Active Directory users and computers, which is a bit of a pain. Okay, so that was a slight digression. So within the list of attributes associated with this IP site link, we've got one called options. And by default, that's not set. It's a bitwise OR operator. And the way it works is that the value of 1 decimal will give you change notification, which is fine. So that's really easy. And you can see there that you get a user-friendly interpretation of that, which says use notify. If you have something that is already within that value, it means that some of the other configurable options associated with that IP site link are in play. And you then need to calculate basically the bitwise OR operation that you need to insert the change notify. So that can get relatively complex depending on your comfort levels. So just have a look. If you need to do that, have a look at the link I've put in the slide deck. But yeah, so if we enable that, basically we've now got change notification between site links. Any questions at this stage? It's all quiet. Must have been a good tech fest. I didn't get to go, by the way. I was working on my demos. Yeah, I know. It's sad, isn't it? For some reason, they always seem to schedule my session the day after TechFest. So I sit there sweating in my hotel room while you're all off having a good time. But I'm not bitter. Okay, so metadata cleanup. So back in the old... How many of us here have worked with NTDS util to perform a metadata cleanup? Okay, so quite a few. So what this is, basically, if you have a failed DC demotion or if you've lost the domain controller and you don't have any ability to recover it, somebody's poured a can of Coke down the back of it and it's just toasted, then you might need to sort of go in and sort of purge that all references to that DC out of AD and then rebuild it. So metadata cleanup in the old days was really hard with NTDS util. And it also ran the risk that you might accidentally just purge one of your live production DCs out of there at the same time, which would have been a bad thing. So with 2008, what they introduced, and they didn't publicize this really well, which is why I'm mentioning it now, is that just going into users and computers, into the domain controller's OU, and clicking delete on the server object there, that will perform the metadata cleanup for you. Now, there are some other sort of cleanup bits and pieces that you might need to do as well. Basically, this is regardless of whether we use this method or NTDS util, but that includes really looking at things like DNS name server records, which aren't automatically purged, looking at sites and services to see if there's still a server object below the relevant site. Okay, so next topic is the admin SD holder. Can I just have a show of hands about who's heard of the admin SD holder? So roughly a third. Okay, this is really, really important in your environment. It's a mechanism that's been built into Active Directory from day one, and it's really to protect your Active Directory against bad delegation. To kind of illustrate this, I'll give you an example. Let's say we've got, in our domain, we've got an organizational unit called Minions. The service desk has got full permissions over user objects in that OU. And basically what happens is Bob Smith is added to the account operators group. At that point, the service desk can no longer change Bob's password. So what happens, they go, hey, we need more permissions, we can't change the password. And then they go into domain admins, and it's all good, right? So we get this kind of proliferation. It's like, you know, arms escalation. You know, just keep increasing the level of permissions until people can do what they want. That's not the right approach. What's going on here is that the account operators group is one of the protected groups in AD, and it's protected by this process called the admin SD holder. So the list of protected groups include the ones that you might expect, so the built-in administrators group for the domain, domain admins, schema admins, enterprise admins, account operators, server operators, print operators, backup operators. It includes the built-in administrator account for the domain, the Kerberos account, and Exchange adds some others, whose names escape me right now. So basically a whole lot of protected groups in AD, and on the DC that holds the PDC emulator FISMO role, so that's the flexible single master operations role, what happens is there's a thread that runs within lsas.exe that basically compiles a list of all of the protected objects. So this is the protected groups, their members, and their nested members. And what it does is it takes the security descriptor from the admin SD holder object, which is in the system container, and it stamps it onto those objects. And one of the key things about that security descriptor is that it unchecks the inheritance flag. So it basically stops inherited permissions flowing down onto that object. It also creates a value of 1 in the admin count attribute on the object. So it's kind of a way of protecting those things. So this is what's happened in this case, is that basically the security descriptor of the admin SD holder basically is limited to really, really privileged groups. So domain admins, enterprise admins, and the built-in administrators group can do pretty much what they like on objects protected by the admin SD holder. Anything else can't. But what I've seen some people do is actually change the security descriptor on the admin SD holder to work around delegation problems. And again, that's not really something that I would recommend. It's just the wrong approach. So what I would say is sort of create your own delegation model, make sure it's sensible, and then don't put things into privileged groups unless you have to. And if you have to, move them out to a separate OU. So a really, really important point about the admin SD holder process is that it doesn't tidy up after itself. So let's take a situation where a user is removed from the account operators group. You would expect maybe that what would happen is that the admin count value would be reversed, so change from 1 to not set, and you might expect that inheritance would be re-enabled down to that object. That just doesn't happen. So if you've had a situation where somebody accidentally adds 400 accounts into domain admins, goes, whoops, takes them all out again, if they've all become protected in that period, then basically you're in trouble and you need to manually sort it out. Okay, so one thing you can do is search for those objects by looking and doing an LDAP search using the AD commandlets for anything that's got an admin count of 1. That's great. It'll find all your protected objects, but it potentially also finds those objects that were protected but are now no longer protected. So that's why it's not 100% reliable. So how do you do the cleanup? One option is to do it manually. So that involves basically going in, looking at each of those objects that has an admin count of 1, looking at the group memberships, looking at the group nested memberships, changing the admin count value, resetting the inheritance flag. And obviously, if you've got 400 of those, that's going to take you a long time. So you think, great, I'm going to script this. And actually, scripting is fine, but it does introduce a small element of risk. So the risk is around the fact that, there are two things. One is that you might have some malware lurking in your environment that's basically waiting for this opportunity and sitting there polling for this opportunity to take advantage of a poor delegation. And so it sort of, as soon as it finds something unprotected, it grabs hold of it and compromises it in some way. Now, it's a really small risk, but you should be aware that it's there. The other one is that you might previously have had some delegations on an object prior to it becoming protected. Now, you've no idea what that is. So you can't go back in time. It's resetting the inheritance flag as a workaround may actually change something that you previously had in place. So again, what I would say is that's a relatively small risk. Personally, I would take that risk because I think the benefits outweigh the risks in this case. So let's have a look at the admin SD holder in action. Okay, so looking at the Active Directory Administrative Center, we'll browse down to the system container. And you can see there at the top we've got the admin SD holder. What are the properties? Sorry, I have done this demo before. Okay, so let's have a look at the security descriptor. So we go into the security tab in advance. Straight away we can see that basically at the moment inheritance is blocked. And it's really just those highly privileged groups that have permissions on the object. So I'm just going to quickly go and run the script that I've got that cleans up the admin SD holder. And I've got a link to this on the slide, so it's on my blog site. And basically all it does is it finds everything with an admin count of 1. It changes the inheritance flag, basically unchecks it, and it changes the admin count back to 1. So what happens then is that all of your objects are unprotected, but within an hour, the admin SD holder process will come back and re-protect the ones that should be genuinely protected. I'll run it just so you can see what it does. Okay, so it does a... Basically, at the end of it, it says, yeah, it does a count, finds that no objects are protected. But at the beginning of the run, the number of protected objects was 28. So it's actually, you know, if we came back to it within an hour, we'd see that count come down from 28 to something sensible. Okay, moving on. This is one that I didn't know until quite recently, and I can't believe I didn't know about it, really. I'm sure most of you do, but NetAccounts will give you the account and password policies for the domain, which is really handy. It saves you having to do GP results or looking at the group policy objects directly. One thing you should be aware of is that it doesn't include any fine-grained password policies that might apply to that user. So it's not a resultant set of policies, but it is quite handy for a quick view of things. Okay, so how many of you here have actually gone through a process of extending your organization's AD schema? Quite a few. Have any of you done, of those who raised your hands, have any of you done custom extensions, one that you've done specifically for your organization? Okay. That's actually probably 5 or 6 hands. And I think that's fairly typical in terms of representation. And a lot of this stems back to the early days of AD, where there was some quite high-profile schema conflicts that caused a lot of problems. And actually, some of those were 2 different updates from Microsoft themselves. So I think it was around Exchange 2000, something about the secretary attribute, and there was a conflict. And in those days, there wasn't a possibility to deactivate or defunct anything in the schema. So once you'd modified the schema, you were stuck with what you had. And if it was problematic, then in the worst case, maybe what you had to do was a full forest recovery or a migration, and that would have been bad. Since 2003, you've got the option to deactivate schema objects and attributes by defuncting them. So you've always got a back-out mechanism. So it's kind of not so scary anymore to do your own schema changes. So what we're seeing in the short term is, you know, people still are wary of making schema changes, and what they do is they latch on to so-called spare attributes in AD. So, you know, they might say, well, let's take the PO post office box attribute and put our cost center codes in there, for example, which is fine, but then the labels are mismatched, and anyone coming new into the environment kind of looks at the post office value and goes, well, what's that? So it's kind of not ideal. And a lot of organizations tend to use the Exchange extension attributes. So their extension attribute 1 to 15, and I think that was changed to 1 to 30 or 1 to 50 or something in a more recent version of Exchange. And a lot of people use those as sort of generic attributes for all sorts of things. Just be wary of doing that, in that they are attributes that are intended for Exchange. And if you mail or mailbox enable a user, or mailbox disable a user or any object, basically the values in those attributes get blown away. So it's something that I wouldn't recommend necessarily. Okay, so in terms of if you're worth considering extending your Active Directory schema, there are a couple of things that you need to know. One is that you need an object identifier as a base to define your attributes and objects. You can get one of these from IANA for free. So IANA is the Internet Naming Authority. You can just register for one, and within a month, I think, you get your OID back. You can also run this. Microsoft published some VB scripts and a PowerShell script, which allow you to create an object OID from Microsoft's base OID. And it creates a spectacularly long OID, which genuinely probably has a risk of not being unique. But because it's so long, it normally is unique. So if probably from a best practice point of view, you'll hear Microsoft say, well, use that for lab environments, but for your production environments, make sure you've got a properly registered OID. The other thing is Microsoft also recommend don't touch the base classes within AD. So we're talking about things like the user class, the computer class, the group class, organizational unit class. Rather create what's known as an auxiliary class. So you create your attributes, you basically link them to newly created auxiliary classes, and then you link and associate those auxiliary classes with the base classes. So what I can do basically is define generic attributes 1 to 10. I can link those to new generic auxiliary classes for user group and contact, for example, and then I can link those auxiliary classes to the base user classes. It sounds complicated, but actually, so when you get into it, it's relatively straightforward. And obviously, when you're doing this, you don't want to just do this in your production environment. And schema changes are something you really want to sort of make sure you've nutted out completely, because there is some underlying complexity. Okay, so let's have a quick demo of that. And this is really just to illustrate the kind of the straightforwardness of this. Holding for time. Okay, too bad. The reason I'm going to a 2012 DC for this is because I accidentally ran it on my 2012 R2 without taking a snapshot. And then I had to stand up another one. Come on, try an app on this PC. We're getting this? Okay, so there's basically the means by which you extend the schema is you define an LDIF import file. The syntax, if you're not familiar with it, is relatively straightforward. There are a lot of really good examples out there on the internet. So basically, what I've done here is I've just running through the file very quickly. I've defined a whole lot of generic attributes. Then I've basically defined some auxiliary classes, in this case called the one called generic group. Then I link towards the end. I link that to the appropriate base group class. And I've defined it here for contacts, users, and groups. Then when I'm ready to run the import, can you see this okay at the back? It was a bit weird. Sorry, I meant to do this earlier. I'm sure you enjoy watching me type. So the tool that you use to import the LDIF file into the schema is called LDIFDE, and that's installed by default on all domain controllers. Oops. So the syntax is hyphen I for import, hyphen F for the LDIF file. Just run it. Basically, runs very quickly for this small number of updates. And we've got 23. Then what we can do is basically launch the Active Directory Administrative Center. We'll perform a global search for my one user in this domain. I'll look at the properties of the user. I really just want to see whether those extensions are now available. Sometimes it takes a little while for the schema update to happen, but in this case it's happened quite quickly. You can see that my generic attributes are present, which is great, so I can populate those. In this case, I've just done generic string attributes. You can get really fancy with extension and do linked attributes and all sorts of different syntaxes if you want. That's kind of a bit beyond the scope of what we're doing today. So hopefully that gives you an illustration that schema extension is not necessarily the big scary things that you may have heard about before. You won't upset the fabric of the universe. You won't release a zombie apocalypse. It'll be okay. Right, so One of the things that early Microsoft documentation around AD suggested doing was to hide the built-in administrator account for the domain by renaming it. Now, that's partially effective in that some people were attacking that for nefarious purposes, might not know that actually it's always got the same relative identifier. So this is a quick bit of PowerShell that basically, if you come into an environment and somebody's renamed the administrator account and you don't know what the original one is, you can quickly find it by basically looking at the domain SID and then appending the -500, which is always the administrator account, onto the end of that. Okay, so flexible single master operation roles and where they're placed. Historically, back in the days when AD came out, Microsoft came out with some recommendations around multi-domain forests where you had a sort of placeholder root domain and child domain that's got all the resources and AD accounts and everything. In that environment then, that was at a time also when globally around the world, network bandwidth wasn't what it is now. And so you had quite a lot of organizations that had really lots of sites on really low bandwidth links. And it wasn't in those days okay to make every domain controller into a global catalog server, because obviously that has a replication impact in multi-domain environments. And so they issued some potentially confusing advice around, the schema master should be on one and it should be next to, or the PDC emulator should be on one, it should be on the global catalog. Infrastructure master in a multi-domain forest shouldn't be on a global catalog. Simple advice is, particularly nowadays with good bandwidth links, if you have a single domain forest, just make all of your DCs GCs. Transfer all of the FISMO roles onto a single DC. You probably want to pick one of your domain controllers that has, the best horsepower is located in the central site or whatever. But generally, there's nothing wrong with putting all FISMO roles on a single DC in a single domain environment where all your DCs are GCs. So what are the benefits of doing that? Well, first of all, if you're doing maintenance on that domain controller, you can quickly move all of your FISMO roles to another DC. When you finish maintenance, you just move them back. And you don't have to go looking around for where your roles might be scattered around your AD environment. For multi-domain forests, what I would say is pretty much do the same if you can. So you might have some bandwidth constraints that mean that you don't want to make all of your DCs GCs. But as I say, generally speaking, around New Zealand, we've got good connectivity. I would say just make all of your DCs in the forest GCs if you can. Then you don't have the issue with the infrastructure master role. You can put basically the two forest-wide roles, the schema master and the domain naming master, on a DC in the root. Add all the other three roles for the root domain onto that DC. And then in your child domains, basically you have the three domain-specific roles on one DC in each of those domains. Right, one of the things that came out of Rick and Andrew's session yesterday, it was quite interesting to see them sitting there moving FISMO roles using NTDS util. Somebody in the audience pointed out, hey, why not use the PowerShell method? Anyway, this is the PowerShell command for moving FISMO roles between one DC, or basically two, wherever they are, into one DC. It's a really good, quick one-liner that you can use in your environment, as I say, really helpful for when you're performing maintenance. Okay, read-only snapshots of AD, and I'm talking snapshots as a kind of one of those terms that people go, oh, you can't snapshot AD, the world will end. And actually, read-only snapshots are different in that they are sort of authorized AD-specific snapshots taken with NTDS util. And these provide a sort of point-in-time view of Active Directory. They're really, really handy. Basically, what I would recommend is sort of you all get these going on your domain controllers. It's really good for looking back in time and seeing what happened. And quite often you need to piece together a sequence of events to, particularly after something's gone wrong, because you really want to finger the blame, right? You want to point at somebody and say, it was you. It's really just useful in all sorts of situations, including identifying a specific backup. So if you need to do an authoritative restore, you just look back through your AD snapshots, find the one that's closest to the change, and then get the backup before that and restore that authoritatively. It combines well with Active Directory auditing, and I'll show that in a demo in a minute. Okay, so what I would recommend is that you schedule these AD snapshots using the Windows Task Scheduler. There's a SCH task command line there that will do that for you. So in this instance, it creates a daily snapshot starting at 5 a.m. You could also get fancy and use group policy preferences to create and deploy a scheduled task and drop it onto or link that GPIO to the domain controller's OU. Anyway, you can do it a number of different ways. What I would say is that if you're doing this, then it's quite good to have a full range of AD snapshots. So you might want to have, say, one domain controller taking daily snapshots, another domain controller taking weekly, and then a third doing monthly. Okay, so this is really just an illustration of how simple it is to leverage snapshots to copy attributes from the snapshot back onto the production AD. And it's something that I don't think has really received a great deal of publicity, but when you think about it, in most cases, if somebody has, say, changed everyone's telephone number to 111, and you want to quickly recover that, your alternative, you can't go to the recycle bin because the object's not been deleted. So your option really then is to either go for an authoritative restore or use your Active Directory snapshot to recover that information. So I've just got a quick script here that illustrates that. Okay, in this case, I've got a user called Adam Cox. Let me just close down this one. Okay. So I'll do a global search for Adam. Double click to look at the user properties. Okay, and currently he's got a department value of distilling. Hopefully this isn't making you feel queasy if you went a bit hard at it last night. Right, so we change it to brewing. And back on the snapshot, it'll still be distilling, hopefully. So what I've got is really just a very, very simple script here which targets the source. Basically, I've exposed the snapshot. I won't go through the process of mounting and exposing the snapshot. That's well documented elsewhere and it takes a bit of time. But basically, at the moment, what I've got is my snapshot is loaded and mounted. And I've basically linked it. It's listening on port 50,000. So I'm basically going to copy the information from that snapshot and write it into the production AD. In theory, we'll see how it goes. Okay, so it says the value on the source object. The source object, in this case, is the snapshot, is distilling. So if we go back into AD and do a refresh, what are my chances that the value is now distilling? Okay, so it worked, which is nice. That was really, again, just an illustration of the capabilities of those snapshots, a really, really useful thing to have at your disposal. Right, so another quick tip, viewing replication metadata. So in this case, it's using a tool called command line tool called repadmin, and that command line tool has been around forever. It's been partially superseded by some AD commandlets that were introduced in 2012, but the AD commandlets really don't go the whole way. So in other words, you can't use repadmin, or you can't use the commandlets to look at replication metadata. So why is this useful? Well, for one thing, it basically gives you an indicator of when an attribute was changed and on what domain controller that change was made. And if you think that through, that's really, really helpful in a kind of investigation scenario when you want to know sort of basically what happened on which domain controller and who did it, basically. So in this case, you can look at something like proxy addresses. Proxy addresses was, the change was made on DC205 in the WLG site. The change was made at around just before 4 on the 24th of August. So you can then go to that domain controller, and assuming the logs are still available for that time, you can then look at the audit information to see who did the change. Which brings us neatly on to auditing directory service access. So how many of you are familiar with the fact that we now have subcategories for auditing in 2008 and newer? Okay, so back in the old days, auditing was fairly broad in its approach. It had 9 categories, if you like. And if you wanted to enable auditing, basically you typically ended up getting too many events logged in the security event log. And then basically those logs roll over and the information pretty quickly becomes useless. In 2008, Microsoft introduced subcategories. Now, I think in 2008 R2, they allowed those subcategories to be configured from group policy. So for each of those 9 legacy settings, you've now got a whole lot of subcategories. And the one of interest for us is obviously the directory stuff. That comes under DS access. The one that's really key in this piece is the directory service changes subcategory. And the reason for that is that if you enable auditing with that switched on, what happens is you can get the before and after state of an attribute value logged in the security event log. And that is really, really useful information to have, again, for pointing the finger. So a lot of things you need to think about as part of Active Directory. You basically need to give it a bit of thought. If you've got a centralized event log repository or SIEM, that's great. Then you basically don't need to think about sort of what size your event logs need to be. But if you don't have that, then the default sizes for the security event log are pretty small. So you might want to think about beefing that up a bit, making it a bit bigger so that it doesn't keep rolling over every 4 hours or whatever the interval is currently. Also, talk to the people in your organization. For example, you know, your security, IT security people, your HR people might be interested in this type of thing, and your operations people might be interested in certain events. Find out what they want so that you can make sure that those are switched on in your auditing policy. The other thing is with directory service access and directory service changes auditing is that it's a two-step process. And now, this is very important in that if you just configure the group policy without doing anything else, you won't get any events logged. And the reason for that is because there's a second step that requires you to modify the system access control list, or SACL, on the objects that you want to capture audit information for. And we'll show that in a demo in a second. So one of the things I looked at recently was a download called the Security Compliance Manager. It's really, really cool, this, if you haven't seen it. What it does basically allows you to establish baseline security settings for a range of different server roles, including 2012 domain controllers. So within that are some auditing settings. So if you don't have an established auditing policy and you think, I can't be bothered to create one, what I would suggest is have a look at the Security Compliance Manager and just as a starting point, take the auditing settings from there. It will typically give you the information that you're most likely to be interested in capturing. Also sort of if you've got something in place, then you might want to consider, if you've got monitoring in place, you might want to consider alerting on specific events. For example, changes to privileged groups like domain admins and schema admins and so on. You also might want to produce regular reports that show trends. So for example, the number of OUs created in the last 30 days. And if you see an enormous spike in one of the values, then that maybe is an indicator of a problem. Okay, so got the demo coming up. So one thing I should point out is that I haven't been able to get directory service change auditing working with 2008 R2. I'm currently in discussion with a product group about this, but if you keep an eye on my blog, I'll give you an update, let you know whether it's actually a bug or whether it's just a configuration problem on my side. Okay, so let's have a look at, I'm on the wrong DC. Okay, so let's have a look at group policy. Right here, I've created a new GPO called Domain Controller Auditing. If we have a look at the settings, basically I've kept it really simple just for the purposes of illustration. The two things you need to do with this, one is to switch on force audit policy subcategory settings. So saying don't use the legacy 9 values, use the 53 new values. And then within the DS access category, basically I'm saying I want to audit directory service changes. So then once I've created that GPO, I've linked it to the domain controller's OU. Now let's go ahead and make a change on an object and see if it's captured in the information. So back to our trusty user over here, Bob Smith. If we change the company value from Fabricam to Contoso, okay that. Then what I've got here, that would be logged to the security event log. What I've done is to create a custom view so it just shows those DS changes. Specifically targeting the event ID 5136. So we've got some logs, events logged here at 12:57. I'm sorry, this might be a little bit small for those of you at the back, but basically what we've got is we can see that the user administrator for Fabricam took an action on the object Bob Smith. The attribute involved was company, and the value, basically Fabricam, was deleted, you can see down there in the operation. So then, looking at the event immediately above that, we can see pretty much the same information, but in this case, the operation was the value was added. And that, as I say, is really, really cool information to have at your disposal in the environment. Again, about sort of finding out what happened in your AD and when it, and who did it. Okay. Anyone know what time the session's supposed to end?
12 minutes,
okay. I think we're okay. There's another quick tip, clearing group membership. So when I work with customer organizations, I generally advise that you keep the enterprise admins and schema admins groups entirely free of accounts. Those groups are only really leveraged when you're performing specific operations. Obviously for the schema, it's extending the schema. For enterprise, you sometimes need it for things like introducing changes into your exchange environment, for example. So here's a quick bit of PowerShell that basically just clears those group memberships, and it's something that you could run as a scheduled task. Just so if somebody does add a member to those groups, it pops them out the next run of that scheduled task. Okay, another thing that's been around for a very long time is the ability to redirect the default containers for users and computers. How many of you here do that? Okay, not very many. So to back up a second. So if you create a user or computer and don't specify the organizational unit, what happens is it just goes into the default container. So there's a user's container, which is a container object in AD. It's not an organizational unit. And the implication of that is that as a container object, it doesn't pick up group policy. It doesn't acquire group policy. So effectively, anything that's in there sits outside of your secure set of policies that you've applied, which basically creates a security hole in your environment. So it's a best practice, I would say, create a staging OU for both users and computers, redirect users and computers to those, the default creation, to those staging OUs, and really lock down those OUs with very restrictive group policies. It basically forces your administrators who've created those without pre-staging the account in the appropriate OU, forces them to then move it to the appropriate OU. Okay, so let's have a quick look at the demo. I've actually got this loaded up in PowerShell ISE, but the two commands are redir user and redir computer. They're actually command line options. The only reason I've got them in the PowerShell here is because you don't have to sit there and watch me type them, basically. So in this case, there's the command. It sits in System32, and I'm basically going to pop them into a staging OU named standard users. So if you look at the output at the bottom, it says the redirection was successful. Now if we create a new user using the AD command, it's called Craig Smith. That's gone ahead. So then if we search our AD environment for Craig Smith, we should hopefully see that he's been created in the standard users OU and not the other one. Craig Smith. Okay, straight away you can see the path there is the standard users OU. So yeah, as a best practice, I'd recommend that you have those staging OUs created. Right, so one of the things that Microsoft asked me to do if I had time in my presentation was to cover off some of the changes that are coming, or that are present basically in 2012 R2. Now, I should sort of preempt this by saying that there were quite a few new changes introduced in 2008 R2 for AD, and the same in 2012. What we're not seeing in kind of boring on-premises AD is any major new changes. And I think that reflects the fact that the development effort now is really on the sort of Windows Azure Active Directory and ADFS. So what is new? Obviously, sort of as is typical with each server operating system release, we get a new AD schema. And we introduced new functional levels of 2012 R2. So in terms of what's linked to those functional levels, not a great deal. So for the domain functional level, if you introduce something called authentication policy and authentication policy silos, which we'll talk about in a minute, then basically you're required to have the 2012 R2 domain functional level for those. There's nothing that's linked to the forest functional level as far as I'm aware. So basically, if you get up to 2012 R2 forest functional level, the only implication is that you can't then introduce down-level domains. So you can't create, for example, a 2012 AD domain as a child. So the big thing from an AD point of view is a thing called workplace join. Who's heard of workplace join? Yeah. So this is basically on the back of some fairly public research from Gartner and others that suggest that sort of by in the sort of 2016-2017 timeframe, employers will require employees to bring their own devices to work for business use. Around sort of they reckon about half of employers will require that by the 2017 timeframe. So Microsoft are really responding to this by saying, okay, well, we've got this concept of domain join, but at the moment you can't domain join your mobile devices. So they've addressed this partially in 2012 R2. So you can now sort of basically use workplace join to do a sort of domain join lite for iOS devices and 8.1 devices. So the way this works is that basically is an extension to ADFS. There's a lot of rework gone into ADFS, and there's a component called a device registration service. So when you join basically your iOS device to the domain, what happens is it creates an object in AD. It attaches a whole lot of attributes or populates a whole lot of attributes that contain characteristics of that device. It also then drops a certificate from the domain onto the device. And that certificate is then used for seamless dual-factor authentication. So the user will, basically when they're accessing resources within the domain from their iOS device, they will use their sort of domain credentials plus the fact that the device has got a certificate. In addition to that, basically that sort of leaves the door open for much greater multi-factor authentication in the future. So as part of a claims-based approach, we know that the Active Directory object is there and it's got some characteristics about the device. So basically those characteristics can be used as part of claims to support multi-factor authentication. Microsoft have also recently bought, I'm sorry, rushing a bit now because we're nearly the end, Microsoft have recently bought a firm called Phone Factor that basically allows additional factor authentication using telephone text information. So basically you key in a number that suddenly appeared on your phone as part of your authentication. So very quickly, Microsoft have also introduced things called, there's a new protected users global security group and their authentication policy and authentication policy silos. Now these are protection mechanisms specifically designed to sort of plug a security gap which involves sort of pass the hash attacks. So there's some really good white papers around security that you can look at that talk about the pass the hash attacks and how we're exposed through the use of, say, admin privilege credentials on workstations and things to that particular exploit. So Microsoft are using these new measures to respond to that. And particularly with authentication silos, you can say, basically say, okay, within our organization, within our domain, we've got the finance group, and the finance group have got these accounts, they belong to these groups, and they work on these devices. And then basically they say, well, okay, only the finance group can log onto these devices, only these groups can access these resources on the shares, and that kind of thing. So that's basically the idea behind that new functionality. So a couple of things that are no longer there in 2012. Nothing too exciting, I don't think. There's a link to more information there. But one of them is that the old command line method for managing DFS is gone. That's because there are AD commandlets now around DFSR, the newer technology. File replication service for sysfile replication is gone. So basically, for those of you who are still on FRS for sysfile replication, it's really time to go through that staged process of getting off that and getting onto DFSR for sysfile replication. And finally, I haven't tested this, but it doesn't sound like you can introduce a 2012 R2 domain controller into a 2003 domain environment. So listening to Rick and Andrew talking at their session yesterday, it seemed like the approach was, if you need to do that, you have to go 2003, introduce your 2012 DCs, and then once you've removed your 2003 DCs, you can then start to introduce your 2012 R2 DCs. Okay, and that is pretty much it, really. So we've gone at quite a pace, and it's been a bit of a scattergun approach, but there were some messages there that I really been wanting to get across for some time. Really hope there was some use to you. Thanks very much.